Welcome to episode 18 of The Endline. I'm your host, Jeff Kasmer, and we're recording the evening of Tuesday, July 16th. We're back, people. Tonight, I'm joined by...
Jordan Angeli. I'm here, back from France, back from the World
Cup. Do you
have
an accent now?
No accent. Just me.
Just you.
Still me.
And I'm Eugene Burke. I am not back from France, nor the World Cup. That would have been amazing. But I'm still also just me.
You came back from Canada.
I did come back from Canada. Yeah, that was really
Canada,
nice.
Came back.
Is that where you grew the beard?
Beard's
been growing for a while.
It's been growing for a while.
That's true.
Yeah.
I gotta get back in the loop.
Okay.
You know.
I was hoping you were gonna say I got to get my beard going, and then I was yes, we're going down into good territory now.
Not as popular. There have been some great things happening in Rapids Land, but we got to start with the Women's World Cup and get the Jordan download. Mm-hmm. Jordan, what can you tell for like people that didn't quite understand, like what was your job assignment during the tournament and how did you get that job?
It all happened really quickly, so that's why I think a lot of people didn't really know what was going on. I found out about a month and a half before the World Cup started that there was potential that I could be going, and then I got the, okay, this is happening 2 weeks before the World Cup started. And I have been working as a contract worker for U.S. Soccer for almost 2 years now on game days for the women's team. And I've worked nearly every single home game for them. So what I've done with them in hosting and taking over one of their social media accounts kind of set me up for this job. They needed some more hands on deck as far as their social cover went. And so I took over since 1913, which is their fan Instagram account and their Snapchat for all the kids. And it was a blast. I basically got to show people the experience in France and make everybody wish that they were there. And so next time when the World Cup comes, they'll be like, I remember how much fun that girl had. Mm-hmm. I gotta go.
It's a long time away. I think there could be some intermediary steps before the World Cup.
Spot? I think it was that influential that people are going to remember in 4 years.
It kind of made the World Cup, really, without your part. In that spot, do they give you like performance metrics? Are they like, we need to see at least 8 photos per hour in the 3 hours leading up to the game?
They kind of gave me a lowdown of what they wanted, and it happened to be, I mean, these games are not just like a normal game, right? There's so much happening and so much going on before the game and during the game that I couldn't really stick to the parameters that they wanted. They were like, yeah, 15 posts to the Instagram stories and 2 to 3 posts to the feed. And I well surpassed that. I think in the final, I had 25 story posts.
Oh,
but
wow.
I mean, it's the Dutch fans getting prepped and ready for the game. It's the American Outlaws at this huge venue where they were all partying before they went over to the venue, and just the atmosphere of being in the stadium and the celebration, all those things. Like, you can't not show that stuff. So, yeah, they did. And it would get like, I was getting on the Instagram, we would get like 10,000 views on these Instagram stories, and then Snapchat is a wild thing. They get like 30 to 40,000 views on these Snapchat stories. So it was very interesting in the Snapchat world. Like, I know Snapchat, but I don't know it as a business model and like how it can help you on the business side. And so I really got a little bit of an insight into that, and I felt like a cool kid.
Oh, well, absolutely. So what kind of engagement do you get back from people? Is that pretty cool to see?
Yeah. My one claim to fame was in Lyon. So at the end of the tournament, I was with a friend of mine who was in town, and we just had gotten a coffee and we hopped on scooters. The scooters are like super big in France as well, you guys. We scooted everywhere. And Lyon has a plethora of bike paths, so I felt really comfortable there compared to Paris, where it was Paris and it's just madness all the time. So I didn't really scoot there. I scooted more in Lyon. And I go around this corner and I'm scooting with my friend, and this girl on the sidewalk points at me and goes, "There goes the Instagram girl." And so, I mean, that was hilarious to
That's
me.
Amazing.
And, but there's engagement and there's people asking like, hey, where are you going to be? You know, how can we meet up? Where are the American fans going to be? So it was nice that it kind of like people came together and people would stop me and be like, what's on tap? What's happening in the next game and this and that. So that was cool.
I just want to call out, it's amazing that you like already call it scooting. Like, it's like, I would say like, oh yeah, we rode scooters, but you're just like, you're already that hip.
I was pretty
into Instagram and Snapchat has permeated you.
It has. The Snapchat really like got me into this like really younger vibe of myself.
Yeah. You embrace
it. But scooting,
it.
I mean.
Scoot, scoot.
I think
I spent
scooters,
way too much money on the scooters.
Down here in downtown Denver, there are scooters everywhere. And understandably, people get like kind of pissed about them. But then I always ask the question, like, have you ridden one?
Yeah.
And people who are pissed, the answer is almost always no.
Right.
And it's like, you got to try it. Mm. It's super fun. And it's like, yeah, they're in the way. Yeah, they're kind of dangerous. Have you noticed cars? Like, cars are a super pain. They pollute. They kill people all the time. Mm. So like scooters. Minor annoyance.
And the weird thing is, I don't feel comfortable riding scooters in America. Because something about being in France, they're used to having bicyclists everywhere.
Sure.
Like in those cities, there's bicycle lanes and there's people on the street all the time. So I think their awareness in a car is a little bit different.
Yeah.
So I felt pretty safe, which I don't feel safe here riding them.
I swear we're about to get back on topic, but so 2027. I'm thinking about running for mayor, and one of the parts of my platform is going to be
just
to turn
drop that in there.
Downtown Denver to no cars from like 19th or 20th Street over to 15th Street, and then like Champa up to Wazi.
Wow.
I think you can't understand what a world without cars is like, a city without cars or a downtown without cars until you see it. But the like opportunities for commerce, for art, for just like community and stuff would be really cool.
Did you just start your campaign here?
Yeah.
I think I probably violated the...
Are we in
the,
his campaign as well now? Like, are we obligated?
Well, you just talked about how you have experience with Snapchat.
That is true.
The young people.
I don't know what I'm going to do.
I think I can convert maybe a quarter of our listeners, so I'll just need like 80,000 more. All right. So, Eugene, as the like tournament started up, I think you were excited about it. Did you actually watch group stage? Did you watch non-US games?
Yes, I'm excited. I don't know. It's incredible. It's just such a cool time. And I think the women's team, not that the men's team isn't cool, but I think holds like a much more special place in our heart. Because I think it was really like in my mind, the first time that I or many of my friends experienced soccer was the first time the women won the World Cup, right? Like in a big stage. But so I watched them play their first game, and then I was out of the country away from the interwebs, so I didn't get to see any of the other group stage games, but it was exciting. It was super like amazing to see that, and I just, you know, as far as like those group stage games go, it was kind of one of those things like leaving and being like, I'm not going to be able to know how any of this is going, but I have like full confidence that like this isn't going to be a problem.
Right. It never felt like it was going to go any other way than the way.
Absolutely.
It's almost disorienting to like root for a favorite. You know, if you're accustomed to watching Rapids, the men's national team, and the women's national team, there's only one out of three
you're
scenarios.
Like, where's my underdog?
Right.
Exactly.
Did Jordan, was the vibe around the group stage, like, did it feel, you know, focused, determined, or was it kind of like, oh, we're warming up for the elimination rounds?
It felt very methodical to me. I think there was always a process in which they knew what they had to do in those stages in order to get where they wanted to be. A result in those games didn't always mean a win, right? If they got a draw against Sweden, they're still going through. If they lost against Sweden, they're still going through. So I think it was just, they played the cards that they needed to play in order to get where they needed to go. In the end, the win against Sweden put them in the harder side of the bracket, which maybe a lot of people, and it seemed like Sweden didn't want, because they made 7 changes to their lineup going into that last group stage game. And it seemed like Sweden was very much playing to, we're fine with going into second place and going into the other side, which in the end nearly led them to the final and facing the U.S. again. So I thought it was really methodical. I thought it was really smart. And they're the only team. And I wonder, you know, I don't know historically if they're the only team, but they used every single field player on their roster in the group stage, which is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Going into that knockout stage, the Spain game was 0-0 at halftime, and I felt nervous, you know, of like, wait, this is not going to script. Do you think Spain was maybe taken too lightly?
Well, it was 1-1 at halftime because we scored and then we passed the ball to them or they scored first and then we got a goal right after. But it felt like it was nil. It felt like it was 0-0 because the goals happened so quickly the goal against the U.S. was so strange. It was tense, man. The thing about my job is like I was collecting so much content on the fan side that I didn't have a credential. And you have to apply for a media credential for the World Cup at the beginning of the year. So me not knowing I was going until 2 weeks before, I had no ability to get a media credential, which stuck me into the easiest place that they could put me as in U.S. soccer, which was with the friends and family. So what a place to sit. But when things aren't going well, it is like you internalize their tension and their anxiety. So that Spain game, no, I don't think that they underestimated them at all. They knew going in that Spain was going to be a tough game, but I don't think they thought that Spain was going to sit back on them the way that they did. They really clogged the field, and that hasn't been the Spain that they saw. Spain is a technical team. They play very much like any Spain team that you think of. The Spanish men's national team and Barcelona, I would say those are the two where they can pass and like methodically work up the field, almost lull you to a spot where then they can pounce really quickly. And they weren't in the first half. They didn't play like that. And that shocked the U.S. And they said that afterwards. We didn't really expect them to do that. So getting out of that game, I think we all just took a deep breath and we're like, okay, now the next game is only going to be even more hard.
Yeah. And going into that match with France was, I think, the game a lot of people were hoping to see at some point in the tournament. Somewhat unfortunate for it to like come relatively early. Did France have the quality to win that game? Like, was the environment crazy? You know, how did that feel?
Honestly, it was the coolest game I maybe will ever go to in my life. I just get chills thinking about it. It was so loud. It was probably 60% French people, 40% Americans. But because of the culture in France and how soccer is so intertwined within their culture, when they start to chant, it's not just their American Outlaws section, right? It's not just their supporters section. It is the entire stadium. And I don't know exactly what the words are to this chant that they do, but it was something about it, something to the effect like, if you're not French, then sit down. And everybody all the French supporters stand up and they put their hands around each other and they bounce. And I just remember sitting down and looking around the stadium at like all these giant pockets of people bouncing, thinking, this is incredible. And for the U.S. to score early, they needed that, and they needed those two goals because the momentum for sure shifted. And I felt like France was just knocking at the end of the game. Like, we're going to get another goal. We're going to get another goal. And for Wendy Renard, the player that they had been, you know, their eyes on, for her to get that goal, it just was like you felt like they could have played. But I think the big difference there was the U.S. is a team who knows how to handle those moments.
Yeah.
They play in games like that all the time here in the U.S., and they always have pressure on them to win. Every single game they play, they have to win it. Every game, they have to win. Or it's like everybody's going to be talking about it forever, right? And France doesn't have that yet, right? They're a really good team. It's probably, in my opinion, collectively second best team, and maybe one of the best French teams that we've ever seen, just with the number of players that stick out, but they don't have that pressure. And that was a difference in the game.
Eugene, when the U.S. beat France, did you feel like, okay, now the tournament's over?
Kind of, right? I mostly mean that in just the level of confidence. I think the way Jordan talked about it is the way that I thought of this is, you know, France was quite good. And I think that any home team kind of just has that team of destiny vibe, right? Where they just like have more momentum than any other team, just because they have that home crowd experience and they're in their home country. And I just like, they have that like extra little bit of grit that other teams don't necessarily have. Obviously we have a little more, but it's just, you know, like that's a scary team to play in that point. And so to have made it through that with all those other factors, to me, it was just like, we're done,
yeah.
You know, like, and it's going to be, it's obviously, you know, with full respect to everyone else, but yeah, I was just like, this is done.
It's and it had a little awesome. Feeling of that. Yeah. It really did. And the hard thing about it is this game was so hyped up. And out of any of the teams, I think France is the team that could have beat the US, right? And could have potentially been that team to knock down this giant. What was crazy is the games are at 9 p.m. for us. Mm. And to sit around all day and just wait for that game. The families were just like in and out, like just trying to stay busy, do whatever they could, because we were all super nervous, nervous in a good way, in a way that you're just like, you know, this is this is those butterflies that you get when you like know something's really important and know something is meaningful to you. So it was nice that when the game finally kicked off and we could just like enjoy the atmosphere and enjoy what had happened.
Both the England and Netherlands games gave me this feeling or reminded me a bit of watching a boa constrictor like slowly wrap its prey and then just start squeezing, you know? And it was like, I didn't feel like the US team came out of the gate just like blowing the doors off, you know? It was kind of methodical, almost conservative in a way, and just, but it felt like you knew what the end was going to be. There was kind of like no escape. Is that how it felt on the ground? Like, did it in those last two games, in the championship game, did it feel like the end was known?
Yes. I mean, the England game got everybody nervous, right? It's 2-1. They get a penalty kick and an opportunity to tie the game. And I think that it's weird. Like, before the tournament, before I left, I had this feeling that, like, there was already this talk about Alyssa Nair and bringing up this conversation that was had years ago when Hope Solo stepped away and got her shoulder reconstructed and Alyssa was the next in line. Like, who's going to fill Hope Solo's shoes? And then all of a sudden, now that it's a World Cup year, that conversation is back up. And I thought Alyssa handled it brilliantly. And I knew going into this tournament, she was going to have a moment where people would say, she's our goalkeeper, right? That we're sticking with her. And I was standing in between her twin sister and her parents, and the penalty got saved. And that wasn't even a good save, right? The girl scuffed it. She did guess the right way. She guessed the right way, right? Which is half the battle in defending penalties if you're a goalkeeper. But the save in the first half that she had was beautiful. If you ever get a chance to look at a photo of that, she's like Stretch Armstrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, not only did she get one hand to it, but both hands to this ball across her body. And she made that save. And at that time I was sitting away from her sister, cause I kind of like tried to bounce around and get different families and different reactions. But I stood up and I looked over and her twin sister Amanda's standing up, and I was like, we like fist pumped because it was, and nobody else was standing up, but it was like a brilliant save. And I was so happy for her. And really, she was the difference maker in that game. Mm. She was the one that kept them in it. And England has been, you know, like scratching to get their way up and like their name up with the US and that territory of like the best teams in the world. And, you know, I think they proved that in this World Cup. They're still up there, right? And they're getting better and better and better, and, you know, potentially closing that gap that has always been there.
So the final's over, and then begins like 2 weeks or more at this point of celebrations. Just like, go ahead and feed our jealousy.
Yeah.
Give us the rundown.
Yeah, well, the final, I guess I didn't even talk about any of the final. The final just, I felt like it felt weird not scoring because they hadn't scored in the first half. And that was the first time all tournament they hadn't scored in the first half. And so it was a little weird at halftime to like, especially for me creating content, like there was nothing. I didn't have anything to post.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't feel like I'm doing my job. And then they end up scoring the two goals. And got to right when the whistle blew, one of the guys that works for U.S. soccer took about a handful of us. Like, they each had two people in their family that could sit down by the field, but then all the rest of the family was up. We were up on the third level. So he took like the rest of the parents, the rest of the like significant others, and brought us out the stadium and then got us back in. Because in these stadiums, if you leave, you're basically blocked into your section and you can't move around. You can't, like, it's not like Dick's Sporting Goods Park, where you can walk around the whole thing, or Mile High, where you can go from the first level to the third level and it doesn't matter. It's like you're in Section K and that's it. So he took us out and brought us down to the field, and it was really cool to see. I have a video of Sam Mewis and her, hugging her dad and him like whispering in her ear, and she's just like bawling, you know, like all of her dreams coming true. It was a really special thing to be a part of, and to see them hoist that trophy. And then we were waiting for them for a while at the after party because they could not get out of the locker room. The girls were having a blast. And you know what I liked about it most is they were just authentically them. Like every single person was them, and they lived out what the celebration meant to them. And it might not have looked what everybody wanted it to look like. And I think they were like, I don't care. You know, any other team, if you look at any football team, any male men's team, they would celebrate with just as much like vigor, and that the women did that. And they were unapologetic about it. I was like, you guys go, like, have a bender, right? Like, just keep drinking until you want to stop and celebrating and, you know, enjoying all these moments. So it was really cool to be a part of not only that after party with them there in France, riding on a float in the ticker tape parade as confetti's falling down on you and their eyes are wide open with hundreds of thousands of people screaming the whole time, like they did not cease the whole entire time. Then taking a private jet or a chartered plane to LA right after the parade was done, and they're like getting their makeup and hair done, and they've all got their like bags of clothes that then we change and go straight to the ESPYs. Like it was just it was like I didn't feel like I was living my life. So I don't know how they felt like to accomplish that, and then all this kind of happened so quickly. It must have been like a big whirlwind, but yeah, I'm so proud of them. So proud of them.
I'm left with the question of like, now what, right? So you win the World Cup, and I wonder about the impact on the women's game in the U.S., around the world. I think it was obviously the deepest World Cup field we've seen, as a lot more countries are building infrastructure and national teams and so forth. And I'm really curious about the NWSL. And to me, one of the parts that it's been mentioned, but I think flew a bit under the radar, was the Budweiser sponsorship with NWSL, and ESPN also saying that they're going to air a couple games. I didn't dig too much into the details, but the question for me now is like, is there a real impact? Like the NWSL, I think like all small sports leagues, is always teetering on the like, can we make it? Can we not make it? Can we make it? Can we not make it? Do you think there's like, is there going to be a bump? Is it going to get someplace now?
I'm hopeful. You know, I think that attendance is number one. Like that, you always want the attendance to boost. And after this last weekend, even without the World Cup players, all the teams had an increase in attendance. But that's not where you're going to make your money, right? You're going to make your money off of a TV deal. You're going to make your money off of big sponsors. I don't remember it wasn't a part of WPS, and it hasn't been a part of NWSL until this year, is a sponsor like Budweiser, you know, and a big name saying like, we want to be a part of this in a bigger way than just saying like, good luck. So it's good. You know, I think it was smart of ESPN. They didn't have the rights in the World Cup to cover the games. So I think it gives them the opportunity to piggyback off of what just happened and cover these games. I loved what Alex Morgan said at the ESPYs, is that as female athletes, we have stories to be told, and just, and people want to hear them, right? And that it's not just the responsibility for these networks to show the games, but then it's like the stories that are around the players and their perseverance and how they got to where they are. I mean, if you know anything about Jess McDonald, like this woman has gone through hell and high waters to make a World Cup roster, and like nobody knows about her story, or like very few people do. But if that story was in a different league, like, would that be known? I think absolutely yes. So I think like that call to storytelling and showing more players on SportsCenter top 10, on SportsCenter, you know, conversations, bringing players in to talk about the league, whatever it is, there has to be more conversations around it. And I think ESPN did a good job of, you know, I think it's a 14 game deal. So I'm just trying to figure out a way to get myself in that.
Yeah. Smart deal. Move. I thought it was really neat. You know, something caught my eye in the last couple of days. I think when we talk about women's sports, women's soccer, it's always compared to men's soccer, right? And it's like in expected to imitate in some ways. And then you have this article come out about the way the training staff like worked with the women on the team to manage their menstrual cycles impact
Super
on their
cool.
play, you know, and that was
yeah.
like, whoa, mm. we're like talking sports mm. and people are talking about menstrual cycles now. Like, this is cool. This is really, really interesting and brings out like my super progressive side, right? Like, yeah, let's have some conversations that make yeah. people uncomfortable.
For sure. And it was a big key. You know, I would say I've always looked up to Don Scott. And if you talk to Chad for the Rapids as well, this is a person that he like is looks up to as well. Like, she's super smart and she utilizes not just her knowledge, but knowledge of other people on how to get that edge. Right. And that's as a sports performance trainer, that's what you're trying to do all the time. And super cool because it affects you so much. And I think that article is a really good read. And one of one of 200 things we did that helped.
Yep. Mm. I wonder, it feels like it's far away to me to see a NWSL team in Colorado.
I tried to plug it on the radio last
night. Oh my gosh, great.
I was like, is this on in the chairman's club? Is this on in the chairman's club?
Stan, are you listening?
Right.
Unfortunately, like given what we see around Rapids attendance yeah. and so forth, it's like, it's a hard argument to make that this would be a smart move, you know, but. I'll sign up. I'll put the deposit down on some season tickets.
The one thing I will say, so like just to compare big tournament with the men's and women's national teams, the one thing I love about the women's is that they're vocal, they're confident, and like just to be frank, like there's like actually content there, right?
Right. They're actually themselves
yeah.
too. They're not like I am a sports robot.
Which is what all the men are, right? For the most part. And like that's like if I had any criticism of them as a team, aside from just them not being very good, that would be my criticism. Is just like be people and like be enjoyable to watch. And like that's why the women's national team like to me like transcends sport to a degree. Like it's like I authentically can get into this like as a person and enjoy them as people on top of the athletics is because they like offer that up, right?
Yeah.
And that's one thing I think that like I would be so excited to have a team here because I wonder if like, I don't know if it's the culture or just like maybe the freedom of it just being new allows that to happen. But it's just like, I think that we have so many talented young women clearly coming from Colorado. It's like, partially, I'm just like, could we have a team that could actually dominate the league? I'll take that.
Yeah, for sure. I think we could. And I don't know if this is the same, but years ago when I played on the 20s and our coach was Tim Schultz he coached with Colorado Rush. And so all these girls, we always talked about Colorado and then they ended up coming to visit and they're like, we need a team in Colorado. Like we want to play for the team in Colorado. So there's definitely interest and buzz because people want to live here. Right. And it's a place where I think on an NWSL salary, you could find a way to make that possible depending on where you live. I just think it's a smart thing to do and you could figure out a way to make it work. And I want a team here.
Yeah,
I do.
We're all in. We're all in favor. So we just need like, I don't know, several tens of thousands of other people to say
yeah.
what they're,
yeah.
they're into. Let's talk about those Colorado Rapids. If we look back at the last couple of weeks, there have been some very interesting moments up and down. There was a draw at Vancouver. There was the win over LAFC at home. There was this crazy loss at home against New England with hours upon hours of weather delays. Recently, a draw in Portland and whatever you got out of the exhibition last night with Arsenal.
Seb Anderson is good.
Yeah.
Seb Anderson was pretty respectable. We won't pick through all of it, but let's catch a few highlights. So, Eugene, the win over LAFC. Were you at that game?
I was not. My wife had surgery that day. So
okay, that's very reasonable.
We'll give it to you.
I appreciate it. I mean, like, I just have to.
I mean, excuses are excuses.
I think earlier I clarified that I hardly miss games. I never leave games on other podcasts. I just have to clarify, like, these are big things that,
yeah,
that caused me
things.
To not be
yeah.
there. So
if you rewind
accepted.
A couple months,
dedication.
People in our community asked whether the Rapids would get a win at all this season. We beat the team who probably will win the Supporter Shield and set the points record this season. Why didn't anyone seem to care?
I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think probably the biggest reason is that I think people don't take the Rapids seriously right now. We have an interim coach. I think no one's like crystal clear following our narrative, maybe except for some of the major pundits. And so for them, anyone who sees that, it's like blip on the radar, good teams lose, it happens. I think, you know, like having the Women's World Cup, having the Gold Cup at the same time also diverts a lot of attention. I think, you know, also the fact that a lot of teams lose players in the Gold Cup, you know, mixes the pod as far as what people expect out of teams. So I think, you know, I think we talked earlier, they lost two players, so their goalkeeper and as well as Walker Zimmerman. So not like major losses. I mean, like if they would have lost, you know, any of their attackers, it would have been like, oh, okay, you know, like maybe we, you know, kind of got a solid in that sense. But, you know, we beat a pretty darn talented LAFC team and nobody said anything. So I think that, again, why didn't anyone say anything? Speculation, but I would say definitely something I was disappointed to see.
Yeah, I think it brings home to me a bit that there isn't a whole lot of story to the Rapids right now. As you said, like with, although Connor Casey's done a great job as interim manager, he's not an obvious like spokesperson, right? In the way that a Bob Bradley is, and players on the field, maybe Kai, maybe Tim, et cetera. But like, who is MLS national media going to get the take from, you know, it's not totally obvious, or it's not gripping and not a story that like writes itself. Jordan, if we overlook the delay game, which I think was just kind of some garbage.
I think everybody would appreciate overlooking the delayed game because it took like, what, 4 days to play
it? Yeah, approximately. The game in Portland was a lot more interesting. Maybe with the Timbers down a man, we should have found the winner. But again, if you rewind a month and you say, hey, we'll take we get a draw at Providence Park, this is a good result, right? Like, is the team, is the momentum in a good place?
Rewind a month. I think if you rewind to the before the game started, they most likely were going in there to get to draw. Like this Rapids team isn't going in there thinking like we're going to most likely win at Providence Park, right? It is. I had a chance to play there in a day game, not even a night game, right? And it is one of the most difficult places to play. It is loud. It feels like the fans are on top of you. And it's perfect, right? It's perfect for the way that Portland wants to play, that counterattack style, really loud roars of the crowd. And I think for the Rapids, after the fact, with the red card, yeah, it was a little bit disappointed that they didn't get the win. And you know, I haven't seen the replay I saw of the handball in the box look like it was both of their arms, and it was look like a little suspect to me, but I can't say because I've only saw it once during the game. But it was just like, why are these games with Portland this year so wild? Like everything about them was wild. And it felt like at the end of both halves, the last 15 minutes of the first half and the last 15 of the second half, like the Rapids had opportunities. But Clark was unreal.
Yeah, on fire.
The guy wasn't just making mediocre saves. He was making saves where the ball would have gone into the side netting and he was diving and popping up and diving. And I was like, what did he eat for breakfast? He was unbelievable. I would say maybe the game of his career. I don't even know him that well, but I don't know how it wouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that answers the question itself, right? Like, we're not actually familiar with this guy, but that's got to be the best game you've ever played.
I mean, he has he has 120 plus appearances in MLS. I would have to say it has to be the game of, and to get that result for him to help his team stay in it with only 10 men. It was a little disappointing. I think the team was a little disappointed they didn't come away with 3 points. But yeah, to get a draw at Providence Park, I think it says one big thing to me is you're going to lose games, no matter like really who you are, right? You're going to lose a game, but you have to react in a way where you can't let that happen like back to back. And that they got a draw after losing, I think says a lot about this team and their ability to fight and to be down a goal both times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My favorite moment from that game was actually, I think, 2 days later, where the Rapids official account, you saw this, tweeted like, hey, vote for Sam Nicholson's goal of the week.
No, no. And they were like, no need to vote because we've got your goal of the week or something.
And then Tommy Smith replied to it and was like, don't you think I have a chance?
I know. I love that. I really love that.
It was a little bit like too soon, but it was beautiful.
No, I loved it because when he scored that goal, I looked at Connor like, that was beautiful. Like, what? Not many people could score that head goal.
Oh, no.
In general. Like, he, what a, I mean, travesty. Like, he dropped his head right away, and you could see the weight of that. The reaction by his team was amazing to score within 20 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, if you watch that, he headed it so perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
But just for the wrong team.
That's Sam Nicholson goal, though.
He's warming up. He's showing us what he can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we have high expectations. This is great.
High expectations.
Speaking of practicing, Eugene, last night we had this Arsenal game. I was just filled with like regret about the whole thing. And I feel like I made bad choices. I paid too much for my own season ticket seats. I maybe had like too high of expectations of what you're going to get in a midseason friendly. I guess the part of it is I remember the Boca Juniors game last year and having a lot of fun and like it ending with the shootout and like the moment where we're like, who's going to take this shot? And then Zach McMath steps up to take the shot. And like, that was a great night. And I didn't get that last night. Is it me? Was it there for the, could it have been fun? Did some people have fun? And I was just being a crank.
I had fun. And I'm not going to say that you're being a crank, because I think that it's a lot of it's like, what are you looking for going in and what are you expecting out of it? Because like, to me, the Boca Juniors game is like, just frankly, like Arsenal's Arsenal. Even if we're playing their 18-year-olds, those 18-year-olds
there's a different feel
are really
about
good.
Them. Yeah.
And so it's like the perspective going in is like, you know, like this effectively is a cash grab, right? They're here to make money. The only reason they're in the States is to make more money. And so like, I'm happy. It's like my perspective going in is like, I'm happy to see them. I, you know, like especially some of the stars, like I expected to see them for maybe 10 minutes. So getting to see them for 15 was a bonus. And you know, I actually was amazed to see how talented the people that were like probably never going to ever play for Arsenal were. And just like seeing that comparison between not necessarily our best players, but like players who like get minutes on the team and just being like, holy wow. Like absolute perspective to see like the difference in what our leagues look like.
And it's just all training, right? The way that they trained at such a young age, being in the Arsenal Academy since they probably were 14, 13 years old, there's like a couple of things that I noticed, just the way that they defend. Nobody ever got one-two'd. It was like, if Eugene passed the ball and he went to go run, like, you're not getting the ball back without me, like, muscling you down. Our players don't do that. And I've talked about that a lot of defensively. I think there needs to be more bodies and more hands, like, more checking where the player is at. And then their ability to face their body up and take a first touch into the proper space with the right weight. It was just a thing of beauty. I don't remember the kid's name, number 41 in the midfield. He had time after time. He's playing one of the two like pivot positions, the sixes. And he just little things like that, like shaping your body up, putting yourself in a right position. So then whatever ball you want to play next, you're able to play it. I really loved watching that. It was cool. But also, how about Abubakar coming in?
Oh my gosh.
And he was handling Aubameyang. I was like, okay.
I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, did you see how he was getting under Lacazette's? As Lacazette?
Yeah.
He was like, he did not like him. Like, they like literally had a moment where he pushed him and Lacazette turns around and just is like, did you just push me? And is like, the camera's focusing on his face. And
oh,
he's just
I didn't
like,
see that.
Like just That's mean hilarious. Mugging him. It was amazing.
But also, like, Lawless, careful. We want you to stick around.
Yeah, exactly. There was some tweet that was if you're a Rapids defender and you hurt an Arsenal player, like go ahead and fire yourself and walk out. You know,
just like launch yourself
into
the sun.
No, I don't care. I mean, I don't ever want anybody to get hurt. Don't get me wrong, but like, I want Lawless to stay on our team and not somebody see him play in these games.
Sure.
Well, and that's the trick of playing him in this game is like, I can't imagine the price for him went down after this game.
No.
So, geez.
I mean, it was 15 minutes, really, but like. 15 minutes, you bring him in when you bring in the stars of Arsenal. And he's like, okay.
Yeah, I got this. No problem.
I will say just one quick thing to the talent of the Arsenal kids. There was one moment where Martinelli, who I think scored the last goal,
yeah.
he was put in a tough position on the right side. And he like he chested a ball and then headed it. And it was like directly to one of his teammates who was like completely out of vision of him. And just yeah. like crazy awareness of mm-hmm. his team and of space. And it was just like flabbergasting to see that.
Yeah.
The chested goal. I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen a goal scored off someone's chest before.
Oh, it was incredible.
So sweet. The conversation my wife and I were in for half an hour or something last night.
You really enjoyed the game, huh? You guys were just chatting for half an hour.
Well,
about
we were down one kid, and so you could actually talk.
You could talk. So you guys really did actually enjoy.
Yeah, we only had two
so
kids
there
with
you
us.
Go. It was good.
Yeah,
it
was, I just I was surprised.
Good. Take that wet blanket off.
That's right. That's
There's
right.
happiness.
So here's the like unanswerable question, and you know we could spend a whole episode talking about this, but the thing I always wonder is for somebody like Nico Mesquita, who I think we all enjoy watching, super hardworking guy, has like moments of brilliance and moments where you're like, oh, I want to see better. I wish you could know what percentage of his potential he's captured as somebody who's gone around different clubs, different training organizations and so forth. Like if you take him 7 years ago and somehow are just like, you're
Go
in the
here.
Arsenal system now. And then he shows up to that game. Does he have that awareness? Does he have that touch? Does he have, you know, for, and what I'm saying is like, Nico, just as an example, like anyone who plays at a high level, is it that as a career MLS person, more or less, are you at the height that you could get, or is it the height that you're elevated to? The height, is that only as high as you can be kind of pushed? Given the systems we have, the resources we have in training.
If you put Seb Anderson in Arsenal, he would get better. I think his potential would be more reached.
Is it like...
are you saying is that potential or is that training environment that then expands your potential?
Yeah, like let's say Seb, you know, Rapids aside, let's say he stays in MLS for his career. Is his ceiling like 80, 82% of his potential? And if he's... moves to Arsenal next winter, now his ceiling is 94% of his potential? Or is it like in MLS he can hit 90% and on a true top flight everything he can get 92%?
Yeah.
I would say you're thinking about it right, but I would argue almost like, so the way I think of it is so like Arsenal, like just a better system, right? They've just been around longer, they've had it for longer. We probably raise his floor, not his ceiling. Right. And I think like he is guaranteed odds out going to be a better player, like regardless of what direction he takes. But I don't know if his potential increases. To me, I think like I've always considered it in the sense of like, I think 10% of all players are just going to be good no matter what situation, no matter what context, no matter who coaches them, they're just going to stand out. I think almost everyone else, it's like the right situations, the right mm-hmm. coach, the right opportunity. And it could make it or break it, right? Like their potential to be unlocked is just there waiting to be unlocked by someone, some situation. And so like realistically, like if Mesquita, I don't know, you know, like meets up with a Klopp at a certain point in his career, he could have been, you know, like one of the most incredible players of all time, right? It's just, we just will never know.
And I think it's hard for me to think that a place like England, a small country, has more potential athletically than a gigantic country like America, right? Like there has to be more potential in the players that are here when then you're comparing to these EPL teams. Like clearly it's the system that allows them to flourish.
Yeah.
Well, it's just an established system and it's been around for a long time. And I think one of the things that MLS has done well in the last few years is creating these development academies and, you know, allowing kids to work through them and then get to the pros as quickly as possible and then sell them. So then not only does the club get money, you can then grow as a club, but then one of the players that grew up in your club now is showing you off and getting better in a different league.
Yeah. I think it's one of the long-term dangers for the Rapids. And I was talking to Sam Stachkol about this a bit. Like so much attention is paid to the roster and like how much money is spent on the roster. And there's so little attention to all the non-players, right? And we, like, I think Chad doing strength and conditioning with the team, super interesting. And likely, I'm not an expert, but I assume that he does great work. I think LAFC has like 12 Chads or 14 Chads or however many Chads they want, right? It's like
I think the whole team of Chads.
It's just an army of Chads, right? And the Rapids, given where they are with budgets and structures and attendance and all that, it's like you have to make do. You have to make do with like one person here or two people who are trying to get four people's work done. And the danger to me is that I think that's the kind of work that compounds, right? And maybe can the young players that we're now pinning all our hopes on, can they develop in the way that they really deserve to? Like, do we have enough, just enough bodies? And then on top of the bodies, like, are they expert enough? And I don't know. That to me is like the big question for the organization over the next like 5 to 10 years.
Well, I think it especially makes sense in this like concept of potential and training and like, you know, and I really do think like, how do we raise the floor for all of these players? Because like, I think that's the most sustainable model for the Rapids moving forward is to have the best, if not the best youth development system, probably in North America. Because you know, like there's just a lot of things against us. And I think that until we can do that, you know, I think there's just a lot of things to overcome. And I think, you know, so to your point, like, I think we are moving that direction. I think obviously there's a lot of great work that's been done. I mean, we can see it in Cole and we can see it in Sam Vines. We can see it in a lot of these players coming up that, they're different, right? There's just something that's happened to them and in their lives and in their experiences. But I agree. I hope there's more and more investment put on that side just because of the returns seem to be absolutely worth it.
Yeah, the part I wonder about, you know, when we talk about transfers and transfer fees and kind of paying off the investment that go into youth systems and so forth, the numbers aren't really that big. When you talk about some of the players that are getting transferred out, having come up through development academies and so forth, it's this guy's going, oh, to Bayern Munich, cool, $2 million. It's like, what is $2 million? In the course of an athletic team, right? You just take one high skill trainer, I'm going to presume that they're in the range of 100, 150K a year. Like, you make $2 million after you paid the player $500,000 over the last couple of years or whatever. That this like profit starts to just shrink and disappear really quickly. If you're talking about a couple million at a time, it's only when you get to 10, 20, 30 million for a player that it starts to really change the way you can run the business. And I worry that we're going to get to a spot 2 years from now where guys are maturing, they're showing, and they feel this pull of like, hey, I want to get to the top of the top. And so then the big moment we've all been waiting for is like, hooray, you transferred to Chelsea for $2 million. And it's like, okay, more or less business as usual.
Well, and I think, I don't want to go too far down this path because I have so many opinions. But so probably the biggest stifling part of this is the regional zones, right? So it's like, we are a team, and like Porg has crushed this, that like is clearly proven we are willing to play young, talented players, which has to be so alluring as a young, talented player who's not getting a spot with an MLS team, mm-hmm. or who maybe doesn't have an MLS team that's like looking for them. And so that's the type of movement is like, if we could clearly reach outside of our zone, we are the type of team that greatly benefits from that, that actually like gets hurt from that right now. Because like Dortmund's a good example of going anywhere to see value in youth, Dortmund in Germany, is it? Anyway. And so like, but they go anywhere to find that value. And they're like very, very open to be like, the minute someone wants to buy them for a reasonable price, we're selling them, right?
Yeah.
And like, that's the type of model I would love if we would approach, but we can't really do that until we can reach outside of our bounds.
Let's look forward to the next couple weeks. The transfer window is now open. Some things are happening around the league. Jordan, we saw Nana Boateng play significant minutes the last couple seasons, but zero this year. How come he just couldn't find his way into the lineup?
Nana was always a player to me that had the flashy moments of brilliance. He was also like Gashi, right? Where they could give you these moments where you understood why, if you saw them in a certain game, you would pick them up as a player that you want on your team. For me, though, he wasn't consistently that player. And at the professional level, what is going to get you into a lineup and keep you in a lineup is consistency, and consistency in little things, right? You have to be working on your defensive responsibilities, your movement off the ball, your willingness to do the extra work to show that you want to contribute to the squad. Really, just like little things, I think, that as a pro, you have to be doing those. Am I saying that Nana didn't do any of those? I don't think he did enough day in and day out to get himself in the lineup. And he wasn't consistent in the way that he played. So it wasn't a surprise to me that he didn't get minutes. And I think overall, him going back and being able to get reunite back with his family, I think is the best situation that could have come of it.
Eugene, expectations seem pretty low going into this window amongst the fan community. Are you holding some hope for players to join the roster?
Absolutely. Guaranteed young DP. No, I don't know. I think that I think I'm definitely more reserved than that. I think not too high of expectations. I know that we've accumulated some cash. I think there's some other rumors of players potentially leaving, which would free up some space. So I think it's hard to tell what actual kind of financial position we would be in without knowing more. Because it's like the young TP thing is a joke, right? But like realistically, that could happen, right? Like moves could reasonably made. And mostly just using that as an example to say like that's the type of splash if we wanted to, we could figure it out. So I think it's hard to say in MLS that like nothing could ever happen just with the way that the things can be reworked. But It's kind of suspicious to not, you know, usually even fans, we start to hear inklings of things by, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of time.
What have you heard?
Yeah, it's like nothing.
I haven't been
right?
here for a month and a half.
It's nothing is the problem, right? That's the problem, is nothing.
What I like happened, the usual cycle is something will pop up on some like rando website, you know, and then we'll like maybe in our little Slack channel be like, did you see this thing? And then Connor will be like, I can't believe you would read something from this. And then like a day later, it'll come from a credible source. And we're like, Connor, stop trying to like shade us with your pretending not to know what's going on. You know?
No, but yeah, I think there's just a lot of, and I guess that's the thing too is, so part of it, right, is like coaching search. You partly have to couch what we might do in the window based on where you think we might be with a coach.
Right.
Because if we're closer to finding who that is, or if we've maybe sealed the deal and we just don't want to disclose it yet, we're probably making moves with that in mind. Whereas if we don't have a coach, we probably want to save whatever financial capital we can gain in the window for when we have that coach and to let them make that just like those decisions.
Yeah. If you were a coach and you were just a couple weeks or months away from getting a position with a new club and they signed this gigantic signing, wouldn't you be like, why didn't you just wait?
I wonder
you didn't
if
know
Eidner
who your head coach was
going to
be.
Could we sign him on a big contract?
We've been down this road, right? And
Can I just say something really quick? I was under the understanding that the DP slot doesn't open until the beginning of next year.
So there's the third one, the young DP slot, or you can sign a regular DP and pay essentially like a luxury tax fine on top of it. And so we know the Rapids are attentive to the like P's and Q's, right? They're not going to pay an extra couple $100,000 if they don't have to, but you could.
Unless it's the right player and the coach wants that player.
I know. Messi's right. Like, I love Colorado.
I'm sure if Messi wanted to come, they'd pay the $200,000.
And so hypothetically, you could sign a young DP and you would you would only owe like their salary. So you could do it. I think there are, I don't think it is totally known, even if people say that they know, but I think like only Porig knows. If there were a scenario where the team all of a sudden said like, hey, two DPs in July, what does that mean? Like, is that possible with the Gashi buyout or not? Porig said to me that the Gashi salary continues to hit this season's from like a budgetary salary cap standpoint.
Well, yeah, because it is through this, that was his contract.
Yeah.
Through this season.
I think though, if you had bought him out during last season, even if the buyout included this season, then it wouldn't have. So all these things are fuzzy. I feel like he's one of the dozen people who actually understands the rules like in the whole league. And so I feel like if there's a way to work the system, he'll find it is like my faith in Porig. But so I think young DP possible, unlikely, right? And you haven't seen anything. You haven't heard the team say anything of like, oh, we're looking to add somebody to the, you know, midfield, back line, whatever. You haven't seen any rumors pop up. So maybe it's still that World Cup, Gold Cup lull kind of casting shadows over the transfer market. But yeah, nothing yet.
It does seem though, and I can't speak like from a fan perspective of other teams, but that our front office has like tighter lips as far as what gets out. Because it really does seem like with many other teams, there's like rampant speculation on basically every aspect of the sport. Whereas for us, it's like, oh, X player's being brought in that no one's ever heard of before, but seems pretty good. But like there were no rumors. There was no indication. That just seems to be like, I was actually surprised that rumors came out about the coaching search because like that doesn't really happen unless we want it to, right?
Yeah, I think it goes both ways. So you get into the like conspiracy of the conspiracy of the conspiracy situation, but like when the article comes
out,
which
is where we spend most of our time.
Right, right. Which is the only thing to do as fans. When the article comes out saying Josh Wolf, the Rapids don't want to pay enough for Josh Wolf, it's like, where does that story come from? There are limited places, right? From the team, doesn't make any sense. From a Josh Wolf world or Josh Wolf's friend or Josh Wolf's agent, starts to make some sense, right? And so I think with my hypothesis with player rumors is that they are not, it's not your Uber driver overheard something and starts tweeting it. It is.
Ooh, that'd be a good account though. I would follow that.
Uber transfers.
Uber transfers.
Yeah.
Although
Lyft, let's be fair, Uber are kind of terrible people. So you should always use Lyft.
Rideshare rumors.
Rideshare rumors. Yeah.
Got three followers right here.
Boom. I think they are, I don't think there are leaks in the sense of random people or the custodian picked up a paper. It's somebody's agent, it's somebody's brother or mom, like is intentionally like, you know. So yeah, I don't know what that says about the team. You brought up the coaching search, and I think if you're a player, it's unwise to sign a contract for a team that you don't know who the coach is, right? And you look at this situation in Atlanta with Frank DeBoer and Pity Martinez that looks like it's headed questionable or bad directions. It's like you got to have coach player alignment or things, even great players all of a sudden become maybe liabilities on the field. If you don't announce the coach, you probably can't announce players unless maybe you know who the coach is, but it's just not announced yet. But now that means that in the player negotiations, you're telling them like, hey, we know who the coach is. It's this person, but don't tell anybody. So then that should start leaking out. I don't know. It's just like fuzzy and complicated. But the fact that there's no rumors, no news, makes me think that there will continue
to be more. On player or coaches, Stanfront?
Yeah. There hasn't been anything on coaches in like a month, 6 weeks, which makes me think it's done.
Yeah. There's definitely, so yeah, to clarify for you, there's rumors on coaches, nothing at all on players that I've seen at least. I don't know if it's done. I would say that it's at least in the finishing stages, yeah. At the very least. Because to me, like the timing just makes too much sense. It's like this is a perfect time for transition. Teams are kind of coming back into it. Like ideally, it would have been during the kind of Gold Cup break, but whatever. So I don't know. But part of me wonders, right? And I think this is the key: is like as much as we want to say names of people who have exciting potential as coaches, Casey's done it, right? Like he's killed it. And so I think that it's the delay makes me really wonder, is he a legitimate option? And it would be hard to say he's not, because he's proven this league he can win.
I think the answer is no. You know, I think the team, based on the way they've made mistakes and then changed behaviors, I think almost no matter what he does, short of like MLS Cup, you know, short of a miracle, I don't think he can earn his way into that spot because of Pablo and because of like the Hudson coaching saga, right? And I feel like the lesson learned now is like, we have to have a person who's proven, who has this experience or whatever. And I don't know enough. I mean, I feel like this is stuff you don't want to say anything on, Jordan, but like, I don't know if what Casey's done so far, is that sustainable? Like, is this style of play, is this style of coaching, like, can this be an all the time kind of approach? Or is it the kind of thing that once there's a little bit of film on it, it's like, okay, now everybody knows what they're going to expect and knows what to expect, and they're going to know how to play against it. Do you have any opinion on that?
Just an opinion on, they're playing very defensive, two blocks of for maybe even one of those blocks being a five block and just defending. That's what we talked about this at the beginning of the podcast. That's what Spain did to the U.S. and it was really hard for the U.S. to break it down. The U.S. is the best women's team in the world. So is it sustainable? Will you win every single game? No, but it's hard. Teams want the game to be open. Portland wanted the game to be open this past weekend. And when it's not, it makes it challenging on how we are. We're going to have the majority of the possession, but that possession is not going to be in the places that we want. Is that style of play sustainable? Yeah. I mean, we've seen that from Italy for years in the men's side, right?
Yep.
It is. It is sustainable. Is it the style of play that brings in all the fans? Probably not.
I don't know. If you get those W's.
If you get W's.
People can show up, you know?
And so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And but it's not like what Connor Casey is doing is a brand new thing.
Right.
Well, and I think, too, there was an article on him, maybe a month ago. And it kind of just talked through his experiences as a player and the types of things that deformed him. It actually came out during the Champions League final, I believe. It's like he played for Klopp for at least a year or two, maybe 3 years. And just to talk about, like, he just said, like, that had a heavy influence on me. And so you talk about probably the most exciting attacking coach in all of football. And for him to say, yeah, that really inspired me. I really like that. I think that kind of turned the wheels for me to say that, you know, like the approach he's taking is very pragmatic to say, we need to get wins. It's not happening. Let's just take a step back and simplify what we're doing. But that doesn't mean that that doesn't translate or evolve into something else, especially
right.
when the coach says, this is how I would potentially like to play. I mean, that's a hard way to equate that into like, he's going to play like Klopp, but like, I think it's an indication that like what we're seeing now isn't necessarily what he wants in the future.
And there's no DPs on this team, right? Tim Howard, who's a goalkeeper, but then that's where the exciting styles of play are building in these, mm-hmm. these clubs across the country, right? Is their DPs are forward thinking players and they're more in the attacking half. So I think we have good players and players that are capable of changing games, but we don't have a world-class player like Carlos Vela, who is a DP in the attacking half, right?
Yeah.
And that changes the way you play.
If you look at the job that he's done, the day he's told, hey, you're an interim manager, the job that he's done since then is unthinkable at that point. Like, no one could have imagined what we have seen over these weeks and months, right? So he has clearly done the best that he or maybe anybody could have done in that position. And so from like earning it, he's done whatever you could possibly do to earn it so far. I just think that he's one step away from where the club is trying to project itself, right? To say, to like claw into this legitimacy of MLS 3.0 or 8.0 or whatever we're supposedly on now. And I think the former player turned head coach with no head coaching experience, he doesn't have the pedigree that I think the outside world expects to see. And the travesty of it is if he's gone from the system, you know, like you would want to see him somehow stick around and be the next guy, be the guy 3 years from now or 5 years from now or something. Would all indications to me are that that would be like excellent.
But then he would still not have head coaching experience, which you just said that he doesn't have that.
Unless he's at the switchbacks.
But he would have to leave.
If he's like in the family, you know, or it's Charlotte Independence.
So to dissect that a little bit, right? So let's talk Jamie Franks for a moment.
Jamie Franks.
So the concern with him is can he do it at this level, right? And in juxtaposition, Casey's proved he can do it at this level. The difference is we can see a wealth of experience in like what Jamie does and like how he plays and style and all of these things. We don't have that for Connor, but on the flip side, we don't get to sit down. I mean, I don't know, maybe Jordan, maybe you have tea with him on Sundays.
It's usually Wednesdays.
Oh my gosh, my deepest apologies. But so the trick is like that's a window, like what that experience does for Franks is it provides us a window as fans. And like, let's be honest, we have very limited windows into what actually goes on with any of these things.
Sure.
Into what Franks might do, how he might play. like what types of players he likes to utilize, the tactics he takes in different like situations and against, like, he's playing a team that is like better than him. How does he respond to that? He's playing a team he is better than. How does he respond to that? We don't see that with Connor because all we see is these past few games. Whereas, like, he can clearly articulate that to Porik. He can clearly articulate those plans, those strategies. So that's, I think, the wild card for me is, like, we just don't have that window. But that doesn't mean, like, you might say, could you do this thing? And if I could clearly articulate to you that I could, you'd probably believe me, right? Yep. And so that's, I think, the thing we don't see. And that's, again, we can do nothing but speculate. But if he can articulate that vision, and he's obviously proven he can do this, I don't see why he couldn't have a shot.
My gut on it, with no information, no one said anything to me. So we did the interview with Jamie Franks, found him fascinating, super liked it. No one said anything after it. No player, no one from the team, nobody else said anything after it, which to me means it's like a dead end. You know, if he was in contention to be the guy, somebody would have been like, oh yeah, I heard that thing. Somebody would have said something about it somewhere.
Are you saying we should interview potential coaches that we don't want to coach the Rapids?
It's like process of elimination.
Are we cursing people?
Yeah. I just, everything lines up for me for Robin Fraser to be the guy. I think you got the head coaching pedigree. I think you got the learning, the, like, you've struggled and failed. You've worked in a small market team. You've now been with Toronto and, like, seen success and
not success.
And not success. And, like,
sorry, I just had to add that.
Try and, like, build through it, right? And I imagine that he can tell that exact story, you know, that he can get into the interview and talk about work at Chivas USA and lessons learned and things he's learned under Greg Vanney and things that he would do exactly the same and things he could do differently. And somehow I don't see him linked with any other head coaching jobs. So it's like you have a guy that's been linked in some article. He seems to fit the exact mold, right? Like, if he were a player, he is essentially like your Nick Umaskita type player, right? Like, been around, had some success, had some struggles. Nobody's quite knocking on his door. And it's like, this looks like the Porig playbook. Like, go get him.
I still will say, though, like, at the end of the day, you look at both of them and like, just taking some of the context of the teams he's been an assistant for, because, like, at the end of the day, like, assistant coaches matter. They're important, but, like, he's not the one doing it, right? Like someone else is the helm. Someone else is responsible for that. It's the same way with, like, well, Josh Wolf, right? Like, well, Josh Wolf may not have the same style as Berhalter. We don't know, right? He's worked in someone else's system. We can't look at that and say, that's what we're going to get. And so it really just comes back to me. And, like he's had an opportunity as a head coach and he didn't do it. KC has had opportunities as a head coach and he's doing it. Like, and, like, I'm not saying that, like he's a great option, and, like, of the options that have surfaced, very enticing, but it's still, like, at the end of the day, you know, we're being super speculative on what we think we can do and what we think he might do for us, but we have something that works. I think that's the concern for me is, like, we're potentially taking more of a gamble on an unknown because he hasn't coached successfully as a head coach anywhere, right? Mm. And so it really is, like, on one hand, if I were just to say, I have two coaches, both of them have assistant experience, one of them has this record, one of them has this record, who are you going to take?
I have no idea where this is going. I don't know who they're going to choose as a coach. I have no insight. And I'm really happy it's not up to me to make the decision. That's my contribution to this.
I'll say this of, like, if you land with any of these three, I'm happy with any of them.
Who's the third? You know,
Jamie Franks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought we just said we cursed him out of this.
I know. I
the curse has been removed.
Yeah.
If it's just took it away.
Any of those three, like, I'm excited about it. The only way I would be disappointed is, like, rando international person who you don't quite buy into the pedigree, you know? And that's where I think we were with Hudson when he came in, was like from the other side of the earth. And you've done several things, but it's just not compelling in the same way. And I don't think we're set up for that. And so I feel okay about it. I just kind of wish it would happen.
Yeah, I just want it to be done. I just want whatever it is to be done. Because I do think, too, like, that's partly a reason why we maybe don't make like the major news cycle when we've had success is because they just view this as like, well, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Maybe we bring in Frazier and maybe he sucks. And it's just like, we just hype them to have them suck. Or maybe he comes in and it's great. And I don't know.
Okay. Couple last things and we'll wrap this up. Somehow I was like, man, this is going to be a 45 minute episode. Yeah. And then here we are getting deep. Eugene, conspiracy theory for you. I have heard at times in the past, Danny Wilson not feeling what they would call settled with the Rapids, with Colorado, et cetera. He's been getting these really consistent starts over the last few weeks. I'm not totally sure why. I think he's had solid games, but not like standout performances per se. Is this the setup for him to get sold off in these next couple weeks?
Ooh, you know, I don't know if it is, but I will say like the rumor definitely has legs. It's, you know, like he hasn't had the greatest time. He hasn't been super accepted by the fans. He's had struggles in that regard. He's playing D mid and he wants to be a center back. You know, like I think there's a lot of things that like, if some of the other pieces of like him being unsettled are actually substantiated, like it makes a lot of sense. But I will say like, it's like, you know, we're talking about rumors here. It's just like, if rumors are coming out that that's the case, then we have to hypothetically assume like the team's probably not saying that. So it must be him. But so if that's the case, I'm going to assume it is. Yeah, I would say so. I'd say this is probably the window he heads out. Because the reality is we probably want other people as our D-mids first choice. And again, if he's looking at that situation, he's saying, well, they probably want Price, Acosta, potentially Bassett in certain situations over me. You know, not playing center back. I'm not necessarily in the mix really for D mid. I think you're right. Like maybe this is the opportunity to, you know, show our pony and try to sell it off.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to me, a transfer for Danny Wilson is the best case for everybody, right? Mm. To get him to a place where he can be in a role he's excited about, place he's excited about. And it you don't get the sense, although, I mean, he's been putting in solid minutes, but you don't get the sense of like, oh, this is our D mid for 2020, right? Like it's temporary, it's patchwork. So I hope that works out.
But
for
I loved
everybody.
His performance on Saturday, by the way. I thought he did a really good job with the attacking firepower that Portland has. He stopped a lot of the balls going into their feet in that in between the back line and the midfield. And then that pass to Sam Nicholson. I kept saying, like, this is on. This needs to happen. And Danny Wilson has a left foot that is touched by an angel. It is just so beautiful. And he played that ball in great. I don't think that the
touched by an angel
his,
though.
His left foot is beautiful.
Dang. I got to watch more Danny Wilson film, I guess.
His left foot is so good, you guys. Best distributor on the team.
I'll trust you. You're the expert.
I will believe that. I would actually say that's actually kind of the narrative you ran there, right? I think what sucks for us as fans and for him as a player is I feel like these last probably 2 to 3 months are where he's really started to shine.
Absolutely.
And like where fans have really started to appreciate him. And it kind of feels like it is happening at the close of the relationship, which is like a bummer, right? Because it's like it really does sting me to just think about some of the criticisms I know he's received and to be like, it's finally starting to work out and people are starting to be like, I agree. Like he's looked really good recently and I've been really happy to have him because he's just crushing it. But it's kind of like, okay, now he's moving on.
And lastly, we got NYCFC coming to town this weekend. What y'all expecting? What you hoping for?
A win. Yeah, I mean, I don't even expect it. It's going to happen.
Yeah. I got to watch the New York Derby last weekend, and it was entertaining.
And they lost, right?
Yeah.
And they lost the weekend before to Portland.
Yeah.
I think it's a good time to catch them, right? You get them on the road after 2 losses. You get a point, you get a draw in Portland, a team coming back home in the Rapids who, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, right, that I think what's most important when you go on these streaks is like if you have a loss to rebound quickly and to be back home against a team who has accumulated a lot of points on the east side. Like it's not that really matters for us in the Western Conference, but I think we expect to win.
I think they've got a couple injuries also to some key players, but Hebert, their newest forward, that guy's got a shot. He can like hit some balls that are just like, oof, watch out. So hope Tim is feeling spry as he one day I want to talk to Tim Howard and be like, Tim, how come you're so agile this year?
Oh my gosh. He made a save in Portland. I was like, dude.
Yeah. He's looking youthful.
You're a young whippersnapper out there.
Hold on one more year, Tim.
One more year.
But like, we're going to talk about salary. That's a different conversation.
We're actually taking the DP away. Kidding, Tim.
We want Tim. Get your salary, Tim. Get it while you can. All right.
Get your money.
That's it for episode 18 of The End Line. For myself, Jordan, and Eugene, thanks for listening. Good to be back. Have a great week.
Stupid but good.
Stupid but good.
Wow, I feel re-energized.
I do too. I'm sorry for raiding your snacks, man, but like I was feeling
no,
like
please.
I don't feel sorry.
Always. Always welcome to the snacks.
It's like